Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, Anne Kelleher speaking on U.S. foreign policies. So let's listen in on Anne Kelleher.
So, we have people who feel morally impelled on issues over here to correct the wrongs of the world, or some of them, particularly when human life or humanity is at stake on this side. I want to submit also that we have very strong moral perceptions by many Americans over here that the United States is a distinct model in the world for human interaction, and it must be defended as strongly as possible. So the understanding, this is a rather strong moral view of the Americans' role in the world, and this is a nationalistic view of what we should do as far as Americans in American policy. We are distinct, unique. Some of them would even say God has given America a leadership position in the world for very specific reasons, and therefore we must always be sensitive to and support American power or the American approach to various issues. So that's, and I would say they feel it strongly enough that they consider it a moralism. And many of them link it to God granted, just as people over here link it to God's will in the world. Very different approach, however, a different morality, but still they feel it like an epic. Okay. Then, on a lot of issues, most of us would thrash around in here somewhere, okay, more pragmatic approach. What I mean by pragmatic, let me define this, and you'll see what I mean by pragmatic. Realism is a word you might not be familiar with. That's one of these jargon international relations-y things. Okay. But it's handy as a way to understand, because Eagleburger, for instance, is a, quote, realist. What this approach means is these ethical concerns get in the way of an effective foreign policy. Now, as soon as you get morality involved, you're willing to use various means to achieve your ends. But these people say, don't worry about your perceptions, your moral issues yet. Let's see what, from a realistic point of view, what is achievable? What does the United States have enough power to achieve? And what that question should only concern is the United States' hard interests, its economic interests, its strategic interests. That these questions of humanity and morality are important questions, but if you get them all mixed up in American foreign policy making, you start to use American force to do some very interesting things to people. So it's best to not worry about those perceptional or moral questions. Let's first ask, what is, in very narrow terms, American interest in this issue, and do we have the force, economically, politically, or militarily, to achieve it? And that's why Eagleburger and Bush, who are this? You just, that's right straight through. If the U.S. interest is strong enough, like oil in the Gulf, do we have the military means? Well, let's move all the troops in there. It took them 6 months to move enough troops in there so they knew they could win. American military people weren't for sure. Okay. That was straight realism. We take action when we can be successful, and only in defense of a very important United States interest. That's an Eagleburger-Bush foreign policy formula. That's why they opted out of Bosnia. The Somalia thing was pretty interesting. I have an idea that Bush was, near the end of his presidency, wanted to do something because he was accused of being too much of a realist. So he wanted to do something that was a moral imperative, so he moved into Somalia figuring he's out of there and Clinton has to worry about it. That's a realist approach to domestic politics. All right, now, these people, you can see, are in the middle. They have a moral view of things, maybe, maybe not, but they realize that you have to focus on whether you can achieve your goal. Like, you can cry and worry and feel terrible and want to do something about Haiti, but can we actually do something that in the long run will benefit the Haitian people by getting the military out of there? Can we achieve that? Or are we going to get our soldiers in the middle of a nice little guerrilla war in Port-au-Prince, being picked off not very defendable, and it'll be like Somalia. You know, there's a limit to what outsiders can do. I said that previously the week. It's the primary actors that have to ameliorate their interests and perceptions to get along with each other. There's a limit to what outsiders can do. So on this score, a person may look at the Rwanda situation and say, what is it that we actually can achieve on the ground that in the long run will have this kind of genocidal activity not happen? Can we do that? And that one is tough. That's why most people are in these categories and argue with each other all the time. Because they're the ones that are sort of feeling, well, this is worth doing, but can it be done? And if we can't do it, then is it really worth doing? Because we'll just make it more of a mess. These are the people that are trying to deal with those questions on each side of the table. Now, let me just give a couple of examples and then we'll roll through this. This one, actually, you can use the American Revolution. I always like to start my courses on American foreign policy in a place where I don't know another professor in my field that does that. Mostly they start with World War II. You know, the world we have to deal with now in the late 20th century is a world that's very different, and World War II is a good starting place. Well, I go back to American Revolution, people wonder, what on earth are you doing? To show where some of these start to come out as definite trends or ways to see how our presidents and secretaries of state and other people are dealing with the issues they face. In the Revolutionary War, you can see lots of evidence of this, of understanding that this emerging country, and we had to convince other Americans to fight. You do know that in the American Revolutionary War, only about one-third or less of the population actually supported making an independent country. It wasn't a majority at all. There had been a poll taken, wouldn't have won. And most historians can see this after going through lots of records and people's comments and press and other evidences, as historians are wont to do, crawl through all the press reports and everything else. They figured that there wasn't substantial support all over what was to become the United States for complete independence. They do it roughly about one-third were really avid, we must be independent people, about one-third, we'll see what happens. Good old American pragmatic. Who wins? We'll be with them. We won't commit to this. What, me fight? I don't think so. And then another third were really saying, look, we are British citizens, we have redress of grievances under British law. In fact, the argument for U.S. independence was couched in British terms. You know, we're talking about fundamental human rights. We were granted them by the British. That's a British idea. John Locke, he was British. And he is, in fact, the, I would say, philosophical father of the American Revolution. So many people at that time said, no, we should stay a part of Britain and try to redress our grievances through parliamentary representation and other means. Well, the ones that won that war, so when you win a war, you get to write the history. The ones that won the war had this really in their heads. We are distinct over here, we should be independent, and we are the first country, this is 1770s, right? The Yorktown was 1781. So when we became independent, we are the first country to not have a king and to not have royalty. The Jeffersonian explanation of what we are all about as a people really was the conditioning set of ideas for that time. So this is very distinct. We are the first. And Americans still feel very proud about the fact that we were the first to get independence from a colonial power. We set up a government that has sustained itself with several major adjustments over a long period of time. In fact, we say we are the longest single running government in the world with one constitution. Adjusted it a bit, but we're the of course the British argue this. And they said, wait a minute, you fought for the American Revolution was on British principles, where do you think you got them? We are the longest running democracy in the world. So we have a slight argument, but never mind, we're all friendly in our argument these days. Right. And this is also why the War of 1812 Much pressure. There's a lot of other reasons that I can go into at great length, but I will spare you. But the imagery about that war, the explanation we gave ourselves as to why we're getting in that war, is to defend this unique democracy experiment and to make sure it's viable into the future. Can't have the British pushing us around, taking our ships off the sea, impressing our seamen. Very bad idea. Stirring up the Indians in the territories. Because we knew what the British really wanted was to undermine this fledgling, little, weak country. Well, it wasn't too little, but it was very weak. And the British and the French really did have sort of subliminal designs, which has surfaced in the records. They like to carve us up. So the War of 1812 was a very clear statement, we're here to stay. We also lost that war, by the way. The only battle we ever won, well, there was Lake Erie, which was useful. But the Battle of New Orleans was fought after the war was over. See, it took 6 months for information to get back and forth across the Atlantic. Oh well, so this reinforced the imagery of the United States as distinct in the world, as a leader, as a model for other peoples. And this has come up again and again and again. World War I, where we're fighting to make the world safe for democracy, and the democratic forces in the world need us. If you look at the rationales for various wars that we've gotten into, this is, in some form or another, almost always there. Well, then you have this, okay? Very early on, in fact, the people who were arguing against getting into the War of 1812 were arguing from this basis. We are a small country. We have maybe two ships of the line, and we are going to take on the greatest power in the world. Are you people kidding? We're gonna lose. We don't do the War of 1812. We don't do war. Try everything out. In fact, Jefferson, when he was president, this was his approach. Look, we may be justified in being very angry with the British and their actions against us and their designs against us, but we can't win. So let's not fight. British are occupied somewhere else anyway. They're fighting France all the time. What do we care? Just mind our own business. Very realistic. Take your level of power. See whether you can achieve your aims, and if you can't, don't take on another country or get involved in the conflict or anything else. So this surfaced very early on in our foreign policy. It actually was early in this. Benjamin Franklin was this straight through, and some others that were involved, okay? So this very early in our history began to surface, and you can see it again and again. But Jefferson was out of power, Madison was in power, and he was pretty much overruled by Congress. War of 1812 was congressionally fought, congressionally instigated war. Done very well. We were lucky. By the way, you wonder why we won. In American history books, we won the War of 1812. I told people, we won it in the peace treaty. We didn't win it on the battlefield. The British, think of this as War of 1812. What's going on in Britain? British problem. Napoleon is a little bit in the way. 1914 is when we had the treaty that ended the War of 1812. What's happened in 1914? Napoleon got off his little island in Elba and was back in France. So the British said, oh, we do not need to worry about these silly colonies, and they still call us the colonies. We don't have to worry about these people anymore. Sign a peace treaty, we'll take them on later. Let's deal with Napoleon. So the final signatory, the discussions about peace, were very generous to this country that the British had defeated. So that was very clever, I thought, of our, all right, put down our arms, we're gonna negotiate now while the British are busy. Right? Very good. So the peace is what we won because the British were generous enough to give it to us. They had their own reasons. But we lucked out, I guess. I suppose you could make a case that God was on our side, you know, in two wars. If you look at the American Revolution, we won one battle. It happened to be a very good battle to win. It was the last one. But we couldn't have done it without the French, by the way. We forget that. So you might say that serendipity, if you think that, or God gave it, whatever, but in two wars that established us as a country, made us very heady, too, really reinforced this, you know? Must be we are special. And then the next thing that made us very heady, by the way, is sort of a running set of generalizations about U.S. foreign policy, but it really does set our imagery about ourselves, is after the War of 1812, what starts to happen? Expansion. You find me another example, Russia is close, of a small, well, again, it's not physically small, but a weak country that expands. Doesn't happen. Usually a weak country is surrounded by stronger countries and it has to really worry about its own existence, and it doesn't have a really strong self-image. Well, the United States very early on started to develop very assertive, shall we say, self-image, because it starts expanding the Mississippi, which the British had granted us the ability to do that. Then it starts expanding west, and in fact, if you look at what Europeans said in the 1820s and 30s and 40s about the United States, an arrogant little upstart people that keep taking over other people. We got a treaty getting the Spanish out of Florida. We took Texas, and this is the next program. We kept taking things, either by treaty or by force. Who are these people? You know, the Spanish and the French and the British, when they get together and talk about, which they didn't do very often because we weren't very important to them. Each other was much more important to them. But they'd say, what are these people? And the words were not congratulatory to us. So this reinforces this. See, we had in the 19th century an amazingly distinctive and perhaps unique history that a weak country could expand, could really think of itself as important and different and unique in this world, and it won every time. We were reinforced in this image about ourselves. And other countries didn't have that luxury, right? Reinforcing this continually, right? The Mexican War is a very interesting study by its first war, where you could begin to see this surface as a opposition to an American foreign policy. The opposition to the War of 1812 that you can read about doesn't have very much of a moral social justice, we shouldn't fight a war because it's a bad thing to do to people, set of logic. You don't find that as a major critique of U.S. policy until the Mexican War. And if you read what the leadership of the Whig Party said in the Senate and the House, who were in the minority, okay, it's the Democratic Party under Polk that actually prosecuted the war against Mexico. Lincoln, by the way, was a Whig. And he made at least two, really articulate, strong statements on the floor of the House of Representatives opposing the Mexican War, and his basis for opposing the war, I thought, was really interesting. We knew we could win. It was taking us a little long. It took 2 years, and Polk really had to take some flak about it. We had to send an army all the way to Mexico City. Malaria was just quite tacky. We thought the Mexicans would just give up quite right on, and they hung on for 2 years. But there wasn't much question in this country of whether we could win. So these issues did not surface. So the argument against prosecuting the war was on this basis, that somehow a country that was born in a revolution with the ideals of human justice, social justice, rights for human beings, should not be pushing a smaller, weaker country around. And that's the gist of the argument that Lincoln and others used in the Mexican War. I found it fascinating. Have we heard these arguments since? I lived through the 60s, you know, as did most of us in your academic. A different format, but a similar argument that somehow we stand for something, and it's not our own power. It's for something else. It's a respect for humanity, a respect for people's rights, and just because you have the power and the interest doesn't mean you should use force against weaker people. The Mexican War is fascinating. Of course, that wasn't being listened to because everybody was cloaked in justice. The idea was the Mexicans had attacked us first. But after a year and a half, the analysis showed that that was not the case. Care to hear? I don't know. I shouldn't wander on. But this is huge. If you've never heard it before, this is one of my... There's a lot to be... there's an echo in Vietnam. Oh, well. All right, now there is a Nueces River. If you have a look at the map of Texas, this is going to be a loose approximation. All right, you know, Texas is a fairly large point. The river that's the border is the Rio Grande, right? north of the Rio Grande, there's something called the Nueces. In the agreement that the Texans had, you know, Texas was independent 10 years before. They wanted to become part of the United States, but various political, since they were a slave state. There was great opposition in the Senate and the House to allowing Texas to come into the Union. And it wasn't until a little emotionalism in the war brought them in, plus California, which was a free state, so it was a balance there. But the treaty with Mexico that ceded Texas, gave Texas independence, which then Santa Anna signed as president, and when he went back to Mexico City, he'd been removed as president. So according to the Mexicans, the treaty was not valid. But of course, the Texans and the Americans conceded that the treaty was valid. But Mexicans had a different, they were having new presidents every 6 months. It was really rather disjointed, so who knows. But never mind, he had affixed his signature, and under international law, at the time he did it, he was president, so the treaty is valid, which gave Texas independence, and it established the border at the Nueces River. Now, Polk ordered, I think it was Winfred Scott, a Whig, who was general, and Zachary Taylor was in this wars too. That's how he got to be president. The only Whigs that would have ever been president of the United States were two generals that presumably won something. That's another whole other story. But the Nueces River, what Scott was ordered to do was take the American army, that was only 3,000-4,000 people at the time, across the Nueces River and camp in the disputed territory. Well, there was a Mexican army over here who said, our honor is at stake, or whatever they said to themselves, we can't very well have that, and they moved over here too. And there was a skirmish. You know, their scouts and these guys' scouts sort of clashed, a few people got dead. Ah, cried Polk. When that information got back to Washington, they attacked first. This is a true story. Ah, well, all the congressmen and senators knew was that that was the case, so a war declaration was declared very quickly. This is, reminds me of a little Gulf of Tonkin, little incident, if I remember. All right, so there you are, and war is justified then because we were attacked first. Now again, it was several months later that Lincoln and the other Whigs said, wait a minute, I've been sort of duped into this. But meanwhile, the United States was having such a fun time seeing how it was going to deal with its new territories, including California, where there was a suspicion that there was a metal there that would be very useful to us. That was 48, that the gold rush was on. The war started in 44, was over in 46, but even in 46, there was an intimation that there was the shiny stuff in parts of California. So we were having a lot of time. All right, so you see that these people couldn't very well be heard given the fact that we were justified in the war because we were attacked, and it was a really direct interest to the United States. We would have manifest destiny, a clear way to the sea. Some of the first statements about manifest destiny came out during the Mexican War. And manifest destiny is this. We have a God-given right to this continent because we will rule it well. And we will use it well. Manifest destiny is fascinating to read these days, particularly environmental issues and other things. Oh, it was very different in the United States in the 19th century. Okay, there are lots of other wars I can use, but to get the feeling that very early on in our history, we've got these various approaches solidified in the minds of Americans and used as arguments again and again. Now, the Civil War really reinforced, given who won. What did Lincoln's Gettysburg Address say? And the war score? And how many ever I never remember years ago? You know, God has given us on this a unique experiment in human politics. We cannot let that union disintegrate. A real reinforcing of what we mean in the world. What is the meaning of having the United States here? What is it to be an American? And very much reinforced, I think, by the winning of the North. The idea of the South was wrong. Now, there is a linking given. Remember when the war started, Lincoln did not, he was not anti-slavery. This is sort of what people forget. You ever watch the Civil War, what are you doing, Anna? I have no idea. The Civil War series is wonderful on so many points of view. I've read a lot of books, and it seems right on. in its interpretations, in detail as well as in substance. And that it makes that point about Lincoln several different times. He was against the extension of slavery into the territories, which from the South's point of view, when he was elected, was quite sufficient, was against their interest to allow that. There's a lot of other explanations for the Civil War, but this particular one is important to realize because what Lincoln did when he, quote, decided for the Emancipation Proclamation after the Battle of Antietam, which is September, a few days later, he announced the Emancipation Proclamation, which was to take effect in January 1, 1863. And that made the Civil War also this. Look what Lincoln did, and he knew it too, in his writings. Very philosophically intelligent human being. Amazing that he was president right when we sort of needed one like that. He doesn't have one like that yet, but that's what he did. So what he really did is take this and this and fold them together. Ingenious. There's another time, and this is where I'm getting at, there's another time in history where that linkage between what looked like very different, this is highly American nationalism, and this is very much peace, human justice, the United States should be a vehicle for God's humanity. Do I mean that? Yeah, I guess so. Theologians in here are in big trouble right now. All right, so we have these two together. Might be a funny alliance, but it worked. Solidified the Union, gave a really potent rationale for then the slogging through the wilderness campaign in each battle where thousands would die. Gotta have a powerful explanation if people were going to have this like that. Another time in human history, our history rather, when these two got linked was after World War II. Now, I'm going to get up to the present and achieve the date you thought I would make. All right. That's political scientists have a freedom with history. You see, historians just blatch when I do it. They can't stand it. How can you hop like this and see relationship? No, they see every event because it's so distinctive. When you look at the details, it's different. So I said, what? I rejected a history major on purpose. I like linking things that, if you look at the details, don't look the same, but from a macro point of view, are. All right. After World War II, the United States clearly emerged as the absolute dominant power for at least a few years in the 40s before we had a little argument about that, okay? We had 86% of the entire world's manufacturing was in the United States in 1946. The other major powers had had their factories destroyed. Germany, to some extent Britain, France was on the ropes, okay? Where was manufacturing, shipbuilding, incredible, a military potential, military power, economic power, it was in one place. Of course, until 1949, when a little bomb exploded somewhere in the Soviet Union and they started to take us on. They never did achieve anything close to the economic clout of the United States. They were only in their heyday half their economy. With one half more of the population, they only made it to half of their economic. So the United States achieves superpower status, and the atom bomb was only one of the pieces of that. So this, dominant, can do what we want, we thought. Eastern Europe posed a small problem, but this is 1946, we're quite aware of that, okay? But for these two, look, taking on Hitler and defeating all the absolute degradation that that set of fascist ideas represented and winning, again reinforces why we are the world's leader. We stood for something, we led the coalition that defeated Hitler, we saw ourselves as doing it pretty much on our own, although the Russians do think that the sacrifice of about 20 million Russians might have contributed, having Hitler have the bulk of his army around Stalingrad and Leningrad might have something to do. But, never mind, as far as we were telling ourselves, we were the leaders, we defeated Hitler, and everybody should be grateful, thank you. But Hitler represented evil. I think there's hardly a person that would, I do know some. They're the ones that are denying the Holocaust. So talk about scary. But anyway, so the achievement of the defeat of Hitler at great cost to everyone, including the Germans, cloaks us in this kind of morality too. We wanted to create a new world that would not allow a Hitler to happen again. And we saw that, and this was a very disinterested decision, I want to suggest to you. This is unique, as far as I can find. When Britain dominated the world militarily and economically, what did it set up? International institutions, no. Late 20th century, what did the United States advocate all the time during the war and after? A strong United Nations with a Security Council that will work. And we were the ones that wrote, actually it was the State Department of the United States that wrote up the Declaration of Human Rights and the Charter of the UN. We were also advocating the Bretton Woods system to make sure that there's economic stability and prosperity in the world, or at least attempting to, and that is the IMF and the World Bank. Originally, they were designed during World War II to create a world that would be economically stable, and that if any dictator like Hitler would arise, there would be a Security Council with the ability to get military force and peacekeeping operations to deal with it. And that was America that did that. Like the League of Nations, with the Wilson idea, we resurrected it in a more viable form. And some of this is disinterested from this point of view. We really wanted a stable world, really, and a prosperous world. And we thought we had a handle on the kinds of institutions that would create that. And you can actually get a free trade, we thought, would also produce. And it's worked fairly well, to tell you the truth. I mean, people who now, and I'm a specialist in developing countries, you can make all the critiques you want, but remember this is 1944, 45, 46 when these institutions were developed. So the notion of developing countries and their problems, these people are not clairvoyant. So we created the Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations, and a viable mechanism for dealing with force in the world. So a lot of this, and this, and this, all fused. People of a moral persuasion on any side, right, felt comfortable with U.S. foreign policy for a long time. Korean War, look at the arguments about Korea. They're generally arguments about practice. They're not arguments about what we're about in the world. And if you really analyze the statements in opposition and support for the Korean War, they don't impact the way the Mexican War did and some other wars on these moral positions. Few, not many, right? Most of them from the left, which were communism started, where those arguments are socialism from those. But most Americans understood what we were about in the world. And they agreed, be they from whatever point of view. There was a solid core, and this is the heyday, if you will. They criticized Truman, but what they're criticizing is how we're prosecuting the war in Korea, not whether we were there or why. And what is it that finally blew apart this consensus-based foreign policy making that the United States enjoyed throughout the 50s? Vietnam. And it took until 1968, really, for the consensus to begin to break. That's when you had these people and just about everybody over here having a very big argument. And the Mexican War argument surfaced again. Wait a minute, who are we pushing around and why? What do you mean? See, these people say, well, this is a communist-inspired, dangerous to United States interest, a direct threat. See, I should throw in one other little thing. Why if a communism and socialism is so important to Americans, whereas Europeans can kind of, they have them living among them. If you look at the origins of social democracy in Europe in the beginning of the century, it's Marxist. They don't happen to think anything called collective is bad. They have a very different set of cultural ideas and cultural perspectives. Given our absolute cultural determinant of individualism, anything, you use the word collective or socialist or group-oriented, and look what happens to your audience. Whoa, that's un-American. Evil, bad, no good. So, communism seemed to be the absolute antithesis of what we stood for and what was good for the world. And even some folks over here have a little problem with communism. Stalin was not a fun man. So what we stood for could link these. And it took Vietnam to blow them two apart. To say, wait a minute, just because you can label it communism doesn't mean it is inherently evil and anti-US. Where did Ho Chi Minh come in 1946 for his inspiration? The United States. Okay. He wanted good relations. He patterned his constitution on the American Declaration of Independence and some elements of our constitution. And he really thought a democratic socialist approach to Vietnam would work. We, of course, saw him as a direct communist, but we could not deal with this man. Plus, the French told us that things about him, so that attempt fizzled away. So the people in the 60s that understood the Vietnam War is not a war that was anti all those ugly things that communism was. It was anti-Vietnamese nationalism. It was simply a war of power. And that was the main critique from this one. Whereas these people said, no, it's a war against communism. It must be prosecuted. We cannot get out of this exercise. So these two really split culture. And we've had that problem ever since, I suggest to you. The consensus is not uniform. I don't know what the issue would be, what it could be, or what the leadership would be that could create another consensus that will unite major aspects. And I think it would be impossible now because of this. We do not have the kind of power we used to have to affect places very normally. It's a very multipolar world now, very fragmented in power, and I think we're much more aware of our limitations than we ever were before. And once you realize we have limitations on power, we might not be able to achieve the goal. Now let's play a game. Which issue would you like, which is presently part of American foreign policy problems today, would you like to talk about?
Haiti.
Okay, now, what is this approach to Haiti? All right, now you are an American realist, an eagle burger, if you will. Who's very tickled? Where's the name? Virginia, University of Virginia. Actually spends more time in Washington making much more money than a professor. All right, American realist approach to the Haiti situation. Why? Set up a government in the country. Yeah. Vietnam. Right. What strategic interests is there for the United States there? And there isn't much, they say. And can we achieve whatever it is that is there? I think you're probably right. Yeah.
If we do win it, and if they manage to kick out the government there, what would we get from it? And then if it then collapsed, how would it reflect on us?
We'd look like twits again. Yeah, exactly. Well said. All right? I think that's right. I've listened to a lot of comments, and I thought through the reasoned realist position. I couldn't come up with another one. Not a problem. It is terrible what's happening. We can help humanitarian aid sometime, but Now, has Clinton done that? No. And is pressed by various other points of view, particularly within his own party. All right, now, well, he's trying to flop around somewhere. Let's figure out where he's flopping, okay? All right, what would be this position? This is tricky. All right, let's do this one first. This one's pretty straightforward. Why? What would be the, there's so much evidence. We have in the Seattle area a man who has done development work for over 10 years, and he says the repression is more than you ever think. Well, yeah, don't be, not just a minute. We're having a pristine, remember, this is an academic discussion. Yes, you're right. All right, now, remember, we're over here, Now, there, sometimes people flop around between the frames. Here we are. It has to happen. And we have a group of people in Congress that keep popping up in the McNeil era news hour. They tend to have the chocolate-colored folks who really, the black caucus in the House is very strident about this issue of at least three or four of the leaders are, that we have a moral imperative, in fact, one of them used that word, to send in the Marines and get rid of this repressive regime that we connived to put in power. Where do these military people get their weaponry and their knowledge and their training? Guess. So this reinforces the moral imperative. Yeah.
We also look at this kind of all dictatorships are evil.
Except the ones that agreed with us. So we've got a historical problem because there was Somoza. You know, it's interesting how far the United States has come in certain directions that and in fact the opposition in Congress tends to be people who supported the Contras, okay? Supported Somoza when he was in power, and Shah, and some other cheery, Pinochet, he was a cheerful fellow, all right? So we've got a lot of those folks still in Congress that said, oh, these guys are not good, but they're our guys. And the opposite is bad, which is communism, and we must support. Yeah, so you're right, except historically we've got a problem with this dictatorship thing because we've accepted dictators of the right and they did what we wanted them to do. This anti-communism thing that really took such hold that it caused a very interesting distortion. Basic values on suspect. Alright, so here we are. Now, it's good to get the extreme things and then worry about the middle. Right now, this is not Clinton either, I think. All right, now what about this one? What would they think?
What would they think?
Yes, and how would that translate into who's in control of Haiti? Are they somebody we should be concerned about? Will they do anything bad to U.S. interests?
Well, it's a military state. It doesn't have anything to do with us.
Okay, but if you accept the fact that what goes on in the Caribbean is in our interest, would the present leadership of Haiti do things like challenge the canal or be a vehicle for anti-U.S. behavior? Actually, most people would say no. So these people, from what I can tell, from the members of Congress who shall remain presently nameless, leave them alone. You know, what's so bad about the military? If we stop putting all this pressure on them, they'd be a little more benign. You know, let's work with them in a discussion way. The Reagan approach to the regime in Namibia and South Africa, you know, sort of a positive interaction to get them to lighten up a little.
But
we don't quite leave dead bodies all over the place here.
But we have to do something about them because we're looking like idiots because here's these.
We're looking like idiots, these people. Remember, we're playing a role here. We're looking like idiots, these people say, because we've waffled all over the place instead of saying, look. Right? Let's work constructively with the existing leadership. They're reasonable human beings, after all, we've trained them. And the present policy has pushed them. I'm sorry. You have to play the game, and sometimes it's hard, you know? But anyway, they have. And what we've done, and you can make it something of a case for this, if you really believe this, that it is President Clinton policy that have pushed them to doing what they're doing to their own people. Because their own people keep thinking that this person, Aristide, will come back, and therefore they're not being, they're potential insurrectionists.
Well, who's the embargo reading?
Well, let's get to the practical thing. Now, we can see that these are not what Clinton is. All right, now where is present policy? Well, let's continue the game and then see how the two jive, okay? All right, this one. Now, this one says, all right, it's in between these two. We haven't got direct interest, and yet it is an important place for the United States to be active in the Caribbean. It is our backyard, after all. The world is looking at us, what we do in our own backyard. We should.
Okay.
All right, and France is making nasty noises because it used to be their colony. People do speak some French. And always picking on us for something. So we do have to do something constructive here. All right, what would it be? You can imagine maybe a constructive engagement with the existing leadership to promise them aid if they will stop the repression. That's a Bible policy, potentially. It's been talked about in Congress, right? To promise them that if they stay in power, if they be good. Because killing people and setting up these little hit squads, it's just a bad way to run a government. It just makes people very upset.
But if we give that money away and they don't do what we tell them to do and we take it away, then we're the bad guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, all these pragmatic things have a moralist problem. See, so that's a problem. As soon as you go to pragmatism, you can be attacked from both moral points of view. And that's, in effect, what's going on now, I suggest. That anybody, and any pragmatist can be attacked from moral points of view. It happens all the time. If you take that approach and you're arguing with somebody, whether they're over here, if you're on this side, these people could consider these people maybe them. That's how the game is played. What? You're willing to pressure the existing government into doing certain things you want? That's just as bad as having a social justice peace moral, your flaky humanitarian nitwit. All right, but you can see that there are certain policies you can create here. Is this what Clinton's doing? Would you say, coming up with pragmatic policies to balance, what can we achieve? These guys aren't quite so bad. Our interest is in maybe stabilizing the situation, which is accepting the people in power now. No. He supported Aristide, right? Right, now he's got a real problem. What did he understood all this this way? All right, now the Clinton and the boys. See, the problem is in the administration. Defense Department has these folks all over the place. These are their friends. Some generals have gotten rather friendly with the generals in Haiti. They have a long history of togetherness. All right, but really, not all, but some. Okay, and then there's within the Democratic Party itself, this and the State Department. Of several people who take this. Remember all those people on the Bosnian desk that quit over Bosnia? It was a moral position they took. They morally could not keep their jobs. So you've got these people floating around the Democratic Party, State Department, and poor Clinton's kind of hanging out in the middle here, trying to be pragmatic because he cloaks himself in that image. We'll cut deals, we'll negotiate, we'll try and compromise all these issues. So we, for this reason, will support Aristide. But how? Well, we won't send in the troops and go in flying and saying it's immoral what's going on now. No. What we'll say is, we want the legitimate government, and this is cute, this is where they thought they'd make a bridge. What is it the Clinton administration, what is it the Clinton administration actually said is our policy? Support for Aristide, why? Yeah. Now, that's an attempt to bridge this gap. Because what is it American stands for? What is it we were distinctive about? A democracy based on elections and free press and all that stuff, right? So you gotta kind of have some sympathy for Christopher and Lake and the boys who are trying to make this bridge. It ain't buying. Nobody's buying it. But they're making an effort that this, we're not supporting Aristide because he does look like something. Although I know people who know him personally that says this particular priest has a streak of pragmatism, but what would you do if you came to be president in Haiti and the prior 50 years of your history was the Tonton Macoute? Even if you tried to be pragmatic, if you wanted to redress any of the past wrongs, you're not going to look so pragmatic, are you? So Aristide maybe had an impossible job as president. He had not the political power in the country. He only had the force of people who wanted something different and their own rights. What he really is a human being and what his capabilities are has been enshrouded in so much jargon, I don't know. All I know is the one ex-Catholic priest I talked to who knew him personally just said Aristide is very clear-headed, and but he is really a humanitarian leftist person, not a Marxist, but a leftist. And he doesn't like what the United States has done historically in the Caribbean. He doesn't like how it supported the devalued regime.
Yet he realizes American power is important in the Caribbean and he must live with it. He just had an impossible task. Well, the Clinton administration is trying to balance everything. Well, maybe this one can't be balanced. Now, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, it's interesting that the issue hasn't come up from one side, you know. The fact that these military leaders have expelled all of these humanitarian ambassadors, and that's an insult to our pride.
The UN observers.
Yeah.
The United Nations role here. I haven't done my actor thing. Where would you put, you know, oh, yes, sir.
Well, I can't help but wonder, partially because we've got other class going on relative to media and whatever, and thinking about that, whether or not we would have an issue here at all, as far as the public is concerned, if we did not have the media really working in the areas of social justice in a lot of what they published about.
But a lot of the media does this, don't you think? A lot of the media is here too. Yeah. Sapphire and all the boys.
There's a question here that we're kind of ignoring, and that is in their realism portion. If you've ever been to Florida or Miami, we have a tremendous social upheaval going on in our own country with all these Haitian immigrants. These people are desperate. And the other thing that the media is not concentrating on is the fact that this upheaval is throughout the Caribbean. There are the Bahamas. We were in the Bahamas and saw some of the areas that the Haitians have to live in. The Bahamian government, they don't have the resources to deal with this. This is a tremendous social upheaval. Mm-hmm. Plus, a lot of the Haitian people, you know, are infected with AIDS. This is a tremendous problem.
Well, that's part of the underlying why we don't want any more of them here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that's why I constantly thrash around about this media issue, and I haven't made any. This seems to always overlap with other things I'm doing. Cliff and I have had some conversations. See, the media is such an important role in our society because it's seen as part of a watchdog, a check on governmental power. We've called it the fourth estate, the fourth branch of government. We've given it an identity somehow of its own. Well, can the media by itself create a policy? Well, Somalia is a good case that it can. Would Bush have taken any step at all if it wasn't blasted all over the news? What happened in Mozambique? More people died in the war in Mozambique from starvation, and we didn't say a word, did we?
I have to eat lunch, too. What am I going to do?
And the reason we're not responding in Rwanda with the we must do something is because of Somalia. So I can make a good argument in my own mind for the media is proactive in creating the necessity for a policy to be made and creating the need for what that policy is. But then the political scientist in me says, wait, if there wasn't the domestic interest in having something happen, it wouldn't anyway, whatever the media did.
That's
I don't know. You know, what are the factors that contribute to policy making? I can make a case that in Somalia it was very much media generated. I'm not so sure that's true about Haiti. Because there are too many domestic interests involved in Haiti. Notice that some of the press has been very good about this. When the big pressure, Clinton was running around making a presidential land, another, watch whether the president says something or whether Christopher. See, Christopher, or Blake is actually an academic hidden away somewhere in the White House, but if Christopher or one of the lower folk say something, it's not nearly the policy formation level as if the president says it. And what happened when more immigrants were starting to come out of Haiti is the president said something in the news, okay? At a press conference, made an announcement about we're going to put the Haitians, we're going to pay them, we're going to be Panama or somewhere. The president of Panama said, I don't think so.
No.
Talk about a disarray of policy. What are you people doing in Washington? You're not quite coordinating yourselves very well with other people. But anyway, he took a stand, which is somewhere in here, to try to deal with the immediate situation until we can figure out what to do with the larger situation that's going on in Haiti, which we have no idea right now what to do about it. And I think we can figure out why. We have no idea. So I think these are more reasonable than an immediate pressure.
No, I was just meaning that there's more of the sort of social justice that draws us into discussing the issue and makes it more in the forefront. And was meaning that I don't think it would be as much in the forefront as
I'm so embarrassed.
Or pressure on the president.
This is sort of the Carter. Remember what Carter's prime human policy, foreign policy statements were in his election when he tried to put in effect human rights issues? And I think Clinton is steering away from making human rights a central part of his foreign policy, but I think it's there. He doesn't dare say it because of all the awful stuff that happened during the Carter administration. And if he says human rights is his issue, he's moving in this direction, and it makes all these people very articulately upset. So he's still sort of, but I think that is sort of his mark, and that might be why. You know, when we don't have to worry about fighting communism anymore, what's going to surface is the issue that really galvanizes Americans and gets them excited about foreign policy. And human rights is surfacing as that kind of issue. Why is it we're worried about Bosnia? Because the very bad things have happened in Bosnia, and Somalia, and Haiti. So human rights is the common denominator. But as soon as you go to a humanitarian common denominator in our policy, you can see why anything pragmatic is criticized.
8 days.
What if we had a president like Carter, who's pretty nervy? I think he did it out of naivete, and he's lived a wonderful life since, because he staked out a position on tomorrow, which is very hard to make work.
All right, how about?
No? You might apply it in Argentina by threatening withdrawal of aid, but did you apply it to the Shah? No. The military in Argentina were repressive, and so was the Shah. So immediately, if you stake out a humanitarian foreign policy, you're opening yourself up to the fact that you can't do it across the board because you are limited in power. You must accept the fact the United States has limited power in this world. So we can't put a moral policy across the board, and you're going to look bad. So Clinton's trying to avoid looking bad by being a pragmatic human rights person. Your attack left and right. I think it's built in, to tell you. I think it's impossible to make foreign policy. Yes?
With all the social justice and the government and the, you know, government foreign policy and all, we also have to add into the mix the economics of the whole situation, too. And one suggestion that I heard that I haven't been able to think through because I don't know all of the details, but to do something similar to what we did in Puerto Rico, and that is to give tax breaks to companies to go in and set up factories and to create an economic situation in Haiti that would keep the people in Haiti, and that would remove the push as far as all the refugees coming out, not only to the United States, but to all the other Caribbean nations.
Well, let me just throw this in as one little fact. Think about it. The Reagan Initiative, the Caribbean Basin Initiative of the Reagan administration, was an alliance for progress for the Caribbean, which was aimed to do that. The one country, no matter how many incentives you could come up with, where people did not want to invest, was Haiti. Because you have this incredible split in Haiti between the elite supporters of stability, which means military rule, no matter how ugly it is, and the Aristide supporters, which are human rights, knowing you need a new democracy regime in Haiti. And if you are a business person, until you people in Haiti sort that one out, because that's potential revolutionary people killing each other, which is going on now, you don't want to touch it. Business money will flow where there is relatively risk-free political stability. They have enough economic risk to worry about. And that's why. Now, Haiti was targeted as a place where there would be export-import bank subsidies by lower interest rates and all kinds of other things the government can do to target private development, and didn't work. You know, that you're right, but which comes first, economic stability or political stability? In the case of Haiti, it's got to be political stability, because it's just same thing that's inhibiting, in a way, investment in Russia and some Eastern European countries. Don't know what is going to happen. Yeah.
How can you have a democracy, though, in a primarily illiterate society? I just don't see how it can happen.
You know who says, I know, hang on, I don't want you to be labeled, but
is that where we came from?
These people say this. Same thing. They're not ready for it. So have the military, give it incentives to be constructive.
with its population, economic development, to bring stability, right? The same argument was used about Somoza and many a Pinochet, okay? Dictatorship, please, these people, they're not about... There are two ways to attack that. These people say even illiterates can make intelligent decisions. They're not stupid. Okay, so there's an argument against that. And the other argument is, if you're going to have stability, why...